Committee, Subcommittee on Civil Law is in session, and the first bill and only bill we'll consider this morning is House Bill 2469. Counsel, will you tell us about this bill? And while that's occurring, we have two witnesses, Mark Hoagland and Karen Schoensveld. If you'd like to come forward while counsel is explaining the bill for us. Thank you.
Chair, recommend members of the committee. House Bill 2469 is sponsored by the Judiciary Committee at the request of the Oregon State Bar Taxation Section. It excludes Oregon special marital property from the estate of a decedent for state inheritance tax purposes, and defines Oregon special marital property, and it establishes procedures to elect assets as Oregon special marital property.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please state your names for the record, and we'll let you proceed any way you wish to, and then we'll ask questions.
Okay. Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Schoenfeld. This year I am the chair of the tax section of the Oregon State Bar, as well as the board member of the Oregon Society of CPAs.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Hoagland. I'm with the Oregon State Bar Taxation Section. I'm the treasurer this year, and I'm also CPA.
So this morning we're here to try to explain the reasoning behind House Bill 2469. And what really we find ourselves in this position because at the last legislative session we did not have a reconnect of the Oregon inheritance law to the federal estate tax laws. And several years ago Congress increased the exemption amount whereby individuals can pass up to $1.5 million this year onto their heirs tax free. Under Oregon law, though, the amount that can be passed on to an heir tax-free is only $950,000 because we did not tie to this new increased exemption for federal purposes. And what we have found is that under the current Oregon law and under the way that most trusts and wills have been written by individuals, there's a gap in here where at the death of the first spouse, Oregon inheritance taxes are having to be paid where spouses did not expect to have to pay any taxes until the second death. And it's really because of this reconnect and the way that wills and trusts are drafted that we've got this problem. So what House Bill 2469 is doing is simply trying to fix that particular issue. There are other bills out there dealing with maybe a complete reconnect, a partial reconnect, but regardless, we feel this is important to move forward because of this problem that we see where Oregonians are going to have to pay some taxes that they're not expecting to pay. We tried to put together a real simple graph showing how this comes about. The first page shows an example where a husband and wife has an estate worth $2 million. And it's some situations where there is either no planning or someone decides to do what we call an I love you will or an I love you trust and says, I'm going to leave all of my assets to you, honey, because I love you so much, I'm going to leave my $1 million when I die to my wife. In that scenario, there's no tax to be paid on the first death, either for Oregon or federal purposes, because of a provision in the Internal Revenue Code that we have adopted that says there is no tax if you leave all of your assets to the surviving spouse. However, in this scenario, then when the wife dies, she has an estate worth $2 million. In that situation, if we look at it for federal purposes, she can exempt $1.5 million under the federal law and would have a $500,000 taxable estate and would have to pay federal taxes of $200,000 on that estate. Oregon purposes, she would have a $2 million estate. She could exclude $950,000 this year, and she would have a taxable estate of $1,050,000, and for Oregon would pay $99,600 in taxes. The second page shows how many taxpayers deal with this problem and basically try to double up the credit amount that you receive at the federal or state level. So again, you can pass $1.5 million onto your heirs tax-free under federal law, but if you do your planning properly, you can take that $1.5 million for both husband and wife, and so you can exempt a $3 million estate. So on the second page, I again show the same estate of $2 million. But in this situation, the husband takes his $1 million and he transfers it to a trust for the benefit of his wife. And the trust is typically called a credit shelter trust. And it's called a credit shelter trust because it is sheltering that $1.5 million credit at the federal level. Now, the credit shelter trust typically will use up as much of the assets of the first to die as you can, up to the $1.5 million. In this situation, the husband has a $1 million estate, so his $1 million would go into the credit shelter trust. It's there for the wife to use if she needs to. It's not. It's actually subject to tax at the death of the husband, but it's credited or sheltered by that full $1.5 million for federal purposes, and there's no taxes to be paid. However, what we find is that under state law, Oregon state law, we only exempt $950,000. So now we will have an issue that there could be some taxes to be paid at the death of the first spouse. Before I get to kind of those issues, if I finish it out for federal purposes, I now have that $1 million in this credit shelter trust. At the death of the wife, she now has $1 million in her estate. She gets to exclude for federal purposes $1.5 million, and she doesn't have to pay any tax, and that $1 million can pass on to her children. The $1 million that remains in the credit shelter trust, if she has not needed that, that really was subject to tax in the death of her husband. And so it also passes tax-free to her children and is not subject to tax at the death of the wife. And therefore, they've been able to basically double up on that exclusion for federal purposes and pass all of it on to their children tax-free. If we back up and look at what happens in Oregon, under this same trust that we've created, typically those trusts have been drafted so that they utilize the maximum federal amount that can pass tax-free to the heirs. So wills and trusts would have been written using that language that we will use the maximum federal credit, which in 2005 is $1.5 million. Again, we only have $950,000 for Oregon purposes. Because of the provisions in the Internal Revenue Code, if assets in excess of a credit shelter trust are also maintained in a trust that has provisions that require that income be distributed to the spouse every year, those assets can be deferred and they don't pay tax until the second death. They ultimately do pay tax. They're not really this credit shelter trust, but they can pay taxes at the second death. But again, the requirement is that income has to be distributed to the surviving spouse. So if I look at my scenario where I have $1 million in the credit shelter trust, and on the second half of the chart I've showed the different scenarios, if that trust requires that income be distributed to the spouse every year, the Department of Revenue has adopted an administrative rule that allows the spouse to avoid paying any Oregon taxes at the death of the first spouse, which we feel has been the policy of Oregon not to have any taxes paid at the death of the first spouse. However, frequently, attorneys have drafted that provision so that distributions are not mandatory of income, but instead they're flexible. Usually the surviving spouse is the trustee, and a lot of times those trusts are drafted so that it's discretionary income and principal distributions. If it reads that way, or if it reads that distributions may be made to a child and not only to the surviving spouse, either of those provisions will disqualify the trust for excluding it from Oregon taxes, and instead we will find ourselves in a situation where $50,000 of the husband's estate will be subject to Oregon taxes. The dollar amounts are shown that in that scenario, at the death of the first spouse, basically on that $50,000, because of the tax structure we have, there would be $19,500 to pay in taxes at the death of the first spouse. Now, at the death of this wife, she still only has $1 million in her estate because the husband's effectively already paid tax at his death, and she would then have additional tax to pay as shown. So the problem is just that $50,000 in this scenario. Of course, we can have a $3 million exemption for larger estates, and so our full burden this year, we could have a discrepancy of $1,050,000. So this scenario is just showing $2 million, but it sort of shows the use of the credit shelter trust. So that's really what we're trying to do, is to take a situation, again, where the credit shelter trust mandates income distributions, we can avoid tax. What this bill does is tries to loosen up the provision and say that if a trust is drafted so that it's discretionary distributions of income or principal, it too will qualify and avoid tax until the second spouse's death. And it also includes provisions that if that trust was drafted so that children can be included, there are special provisions, which Mark will go over, that allow the children and their parents to disclaim any right to distributions during the surviving spouse's lifetime. So in effect, it qualifies as a trust that can be excluded from tax at the first death. Gets very complicated, I realize. I'm going to turn it over to Mark a little bit just to...
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Under current law, there actually is a way that some of these trusts that, that don't have the correct provisions in them that allow or that don't require mandatory payment of income out to the surviving spouse, they can, you can go in judicially and get the trust reformed. That is not really an easy task, and so this bill has a couple of features with it. One is that will allow this fix, to be able to fix a trust that doesn't have mandatory payment of income, fix that so that the trust will qualify under the QTIP rules. It will also allow the children, that, well, I'm sorry, any other beneficiaries of the trust that would normally disqualify a trust from the being considered a QTIP trust, to basically disclaim their interest and allow the trust then to qualify as long as the spouse would have the only income interest, either mandatory or discretionary, during her life. I think this gets back to one of the things that Kerry mentioned regarding the policy of, at least at the federal level, has always been to try to defer any estate tax until the death of the surviving spouse. And that's really all we're trying to do here is, all it ends up being is just a deferral of the tax and not an avoidance. I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Well, this could be a real challenge. Does the committee have any questions? I'm looking to Representative McPherson. I sort of understand it, but I don't know that I can articulate it yet. I'm most inclined to call on Representative McPherson for legal advice.
Yeah, people are gonna, this is not my area of practice, although I do have some questions that I may try to draw out a little bit more. Although I saw that Representative Flores maybe had a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I get sort of the kernel of what's going on here, which is that estate plans have been designed around the federal exemption amount, and now that our Oregon inheritance tax exemption amount and the federal exemption amount have parted company, they've diverged, that as to that gap between the two, then the rules that are put into the federal credit shelter trust, that is a trust created to take advantage of the maximum federal credit, don't qualify under the state rules. Do I grasp that right?
There's sort of two sets of federal rules. One apply for a credit shelter trust and one for anything in excess of a credit shelter trust. And so those two rules also apply for Oregon. And in that regard, you're right. It doesn't pick up in the trust that we've drafted. Does not qualify under these alternate rules.
Right. And follow, Mr. Chair, if I could. And I think if I understood what Mr. Hugman was saying, that it would be possible to accomplish the goal of this legislation by making changes in estate plans and in the terms of trusts, but the aim of this bill is to enable practitioners not to have to go back through an elaborate process that may involve at least changing documents and perhaps going to the court for reforming an existing trust. It gets the estate plan to where it would be if that process were gone through. Is that a fair
statement? And I think that's our concern, is that it's the attorneys know that there needs to be a change, but our clients don't know. And so if they die and they haven't changed their trust, then they're going to have this problem that they're not expecting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think you've summarized it very well, and that it's just a way to allow fixing the problem without having to go in either judicially or amend all these trusts, because there will be several that will get missed, and it just always does. And it's just it's to benefit the individuals that have their plans, and so they can at least try to take advantage of deferring the tax.
It's a non-employment law. for attorneys. We don't want to make these people come back, because I think typically an individual won't look at their estate plan, but perhaps every 5 or 10 years, and they don't know there needs to be a change. Now, a lot of us have sent letters out notifying our clients that they should consider a change. I know in response to my letters, very few have done anything. And we certainly are starting to make those changes, but there's a lot that we feel aren't being picked up. And probably those that really need it are the ones that aren't coming in. Those that are wealthier, that can handle the tax, usually know about it and come in. It's those that are the middle income that we're more worried about.
Thank you.
Further question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Let's focus on the revenue impact. I saw that in the staff measure summary. It says revenue statement issued, and I don't seem to have that. A revenue statement here in my materials. I saw a reference here in the written testimony to the kind of a limited revenue impact, if I picked up on that correctly. So I guess the question is, and maybe this is a question for staff rather than for the witnesses, is there an analysis of what happens to revenue as a result of this change?
I have the revenue statement, and the only thing it says, there might be a potential revenue impact on state and local revenues. I don't know exactly. I would have to look into that further.
If I may, Representative McPherson, yes. Our sense is that there could, in fact, be a revenue impact. However, if everyone went in and changed their trusts, or at their death they go in for a judicial modification, they can achieve the same thing. So there should be no impact. It's really on the taxpayer to go out and pay that cost. But revenue-wise, we don't feel there would be. The income, again, the taxes will be picked up at the second death, as they always have been. So there may be a deferral. But again, it's hard. It's looking at the impact. If they go in and modify their wills and trusts, there is no revenue impact. If they don't, there's a deferral because it's deferred until the second death.
Follow-up question to that, if I could. I think the reason why the state and inheritance tax diverged from, it disconnected from the federal estate tax was because it was trying to avoid the impacts on Oregon revenue as a result of staying connected. How does this impact on that analysis? That is, if the effect that was to be accomplished by disconnecting was to avoid a negative impact on Oregon revenue, would this change then start restoring that negative impact or causing it to, triggering it, the negative revenue impact that we were trying to avoid a session ago?
Again, we do not feel that it will. It will pick up the tax, but it will be at the second death. So again, there may be a deferral, but our limit will still be $950,000 at the second death. And federal is $1.5 million, and I think it's shown in our testimony that keeps going up to $2 million and then $3 million. The highest that Oregon will go is $1 million. And so all we're doing is deferring it until the second death. We're not eliminating it. We're trying to defer it, which we feel that and even out of the testimony that came out of the last legislative session, is that was the intent, is to not have to pay any taxes until the second death. And so, again, we do not feel that it will have that revenue impact. However, it could be some deferral.
Okay. If I may add something to what Carrie just said, Representative McPherson, I think if you go back, the disconnect with the federal estate scenario took place back in 1997, and it didn't get corrected in 99 or in 2001. And then in 2003, when the last law passed that talked about this, the Q-tip election, it was done at the very last minute in the legislative session, and there just wasn't a lot of discussion or anything like that to really flush out a lot of these issues now. And so I'm not sure it was intentionally done the way they did it, because I think it was like on the last, very last day of the session or shortly there, but when this bill passed, and it was the person that wrote it did it in the middle of the night. So I just wanted to bring that out. So I don't think it was an intentional thing, and if it had been thought up, maybe people would have, I'm sure if this has been discussed at that time, that some of these issues would have been brought up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions, Representative Flores?
Thank you. There might be some confusion, too. We did take another vote last session regarding a disconnect from the federal system, and that was not the same as the disconnect in regard to the Q-tip. And you might recall that there were absolutely no revenue benefits to have been derived as a result of that vote. So that is one thing, that earlier vote. Secondly, I have spoken with a few estate planning attorneys, and they want this fixed because they saw significant concern about that gap. So.
Thank you. Chair Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's kind of interesting. You know, I think I've had mine redone twice, and now it looks like I'll have to have it done again unless we can get this bill done. There was conversation about the revenue impact to the state. I'm more about concerned about the revenue impact to small family-owned businesses. They're the ones that have often spent 20, 30, 40 years developing wealth, and on that wealth, they paid taxes. And this is what they put aside for the family. It's probably one of the most unjust things we have, and it has to do with redistribution of wealth within our society. I abhor the system that we've got. We need to do something about it, and the problem where I see it, because of course you know you always look to your horse. If it's your horse, it's getting gored. But small timber owners, landowners like myself, you have such a huge value in what's standing as trees. And so my option will be to clear cut probably 100 acres of ground, which may not ever get clear cut during my lifetime or even my children's lifetime. It would be managed for sustainability. And you take that away, so it has an environmental impact. And that, farmers and ranchers, we all face the same thing. So I'd like to see us at least do this. I'd rather abolish the whole thing.
Further questions? Thank you for your political statement, Chairman. You always do it. You can take minority report.
That's always the chair's prerogative.
Questions? Council?
I just have a quick question about the, you said that under federal rules, a Q-tip election is allowed only for trusts that have mandatory distribution schemes.
Yes.
And this would allow Q-tip elections for trusts that also have discretionary distribution schemes. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is there going to be any negative consequence or negative impact for that? I mean, why aren't there Q-tip elections liable for trusts with discretionary distribution schemes right now? And is there going to be a negative?
Yeah, well, I think the reason for the mandatory distribution of income on a federal Q-tip has to do more with the purposes of the federal Q-tip election and why it's in place. As opposed to the credit shelter trust Q-tip type election. And at the federal level, the whole purpose of that is to allow the first spouse to control where that property ultimately goes, but the surviving spouse still has to have enough of an interest in it to allow for a marital deduction at the death of the first one. Yeah, I think it's just the policy decision at the federal level and where that trust ends up.
At the time that the Q-tip election was put into place, and again, we're talking about another type of trust, not the credit shelter trust, but when that was put into place at the federal level, I think there was a concern that spouses needed to be able to get that income. Most of those estates where we're drafting at discretionary distributions of income and principal, we actually expect the spouse maybe taking more out, but almost always what's happened, and especially in your typical estate, the surviving spouse is the trustee, so they have the discretion to take that out. So I think we've just seen a sort of change since those federal rules were put in place, but we don't feel that it would have a revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee? Fine. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to participate in the public hearing on House Bill 2469? Please come forward. Okay. Seeing none, I'll conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2469. and open a work session on House Bill 2469. Committee?
Mr. Chair?
Subcommittee.
I would move House Bill 2469 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I'll call for the vote and ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth is excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
House Bill 2469, having received a majority, is referred to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Carriers? Representative Flores?
Yes.
We'll carry the bill.
Thank you.
Further business before the subcommittee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.